Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Yves, and good afternoon, everyone. As Yves mentioned, I'm from the International Service for Human Rights. I'd like to keep my presentation relatively brief because I just really want to point to some ways in which civil society can be... I'd like to keep the presentation relatively brief, just point to some ways in which civil society can be mobilised, because I don't think there are any hard and fast answers to this. I think it's more a case of having a discussion about how to do this. So I'm just going to point the way. Maybe I could just start by quickly mentioning what ISHR does. So ISHR is a service organization. We have the name service in our title, International Service for Human Rights. And we basically try to facilitate human rights defenders' access to the international and regional human rights mechanisms. We do that in three different ways. The first thing is we do training courses, somewhat similar to these. Our courses tend to focus on the actual how to engage with the mechanism, so how do you make submissions, what are the practical ways in which you go about sort of speaking at the Human Rights Council, for example, things like that. We run those courses in Geneva, but we also run them in the regions, primarily in Africa, but also some in Asia and some in Latin America. The second thing we do is advocacy, and that's mostly directed towards making the international human rights system and also the regional systems accessible to human rights defenders on the one hand, that is creating the space for them to bring their concerns, and then having the systems be responsive to those concerns on the other hand. The third thing that we do is information provision. So if you go to our website, you'll see that we produce quite regular updates on many of the main human rights meetings that are going on in Geneva. So at the moment, we have the UPR going on, as you all know, and we produce very short write-ups on each of the reviews and put those on our website. And they also get emailed out to our mailing lists. And along with that, we also produce a hard copy publication four times a year, which produces longer analytical articles of some of the key meetings going on in Geneva, for example, the UPR, the Human Rights Council. And that gives us the space to provide a sort of deeper contextual analysis of some of the developments that are happening at the international level. And that can be quite useful for human rights defenders to know what's going on, how it coincides with their domestic advocacy, and how they can then themselves engage, and how the international system can actually add something to the work they're doing domestically. Where are the points of interconnection? And for us, these points of interconnection are really what's important for human rights defenders. So we don't see the international system as something that you just sort of submit a report to and then you sit back and wait for something to happen. The international system is something that adds to the domestic advocacy that human rights defenders are doing at the national level, at the grassroots level. For us, we encourage human rights defenders to engage with the mechanisms because we believe those mechanisms add something to a domestic advocacy strategy. They're not a strategy in and of themselves. And that's the really crucial thing for us. We believe that if an organization is actually feeling that it's being directed away from its domestic advocacy goals through engaging with the international system, then it probably shouldn't be engaging with the international system. So the international system, we really want to stress, is something that you integrate into your domestic advocacy strategies. You have to remember, of course, that the whole purpose of the international system is to improve domestic implementation of human rights, so it would be completely pointless to allow it to divert you away from your domestic goals. And we think that point is the key to mobilizing civil society around the international human rights system. It's understanding how it adds to a domestic advocacy strategy. So, for example, just to speak from ISHR's perspective, we encourage everyone who, in fact, we require everyone who attends our training courses to first of all submit an action plan which details how they will use what they're going to learn at the international level in implementing a domestic advocacy plan. And after the course is finished, we follow up with them and actually help them to do that. So it doesn't always work. There are different levels of motivation. But in several cases, we've had quite good success in actually teaching people what the international system can add and then having them actually follow through and implement a strategy domestically. I would say that, yeah, for those who do see the system as just something where you submit a report or you make a statement and then you expect something to happen, we would really tell those people to sort of think again to actually go back, develop a domestic strategy, and then look at the international system and think about what are the gaps in your domestic strategy and what the international system, what the sort of advantages or benefits of using the international system are that you could actually, what are the returns on the international system that you could actually then use to plug those gaps in your domestic advocacy strategy. And again, that's really the key, I think, to mobilizing civil society, is to making it extremely relevant to their everyday concerns and their goals that they're actually trying to achieve domestically. Because, of course, when you think of the international system, for many people it does seem extremely far away and irrelevant. I know from my own experience, I used to work in India, and I remember at the time I had never been to Geneva. I didn't know how the system worked. I knew about special procedures, I knew about the Human Rights Council, but I really didn't see at all how that was relevant to the everyday work we were doing in India. So I know that it seems extremely far away. And so I do think that just trying to plug that gap, to see how it fits within domestic strategies, is really the way to go. And there's one actually quite interesting success story of an organization that really thought very hard about how to use the international system to successfully achieve its own domestic advocacy goals. It actually doesn't relate to the UPR. It relates to the Committee Against Torture, which is one of the treaty bodies. The Committee Against Torture implements the Convention Against Torture. So maybe I just quickly talk through that case study, because I think it pulls out some interesting points about how the international system adds something to domestic goals. So this is a case from Northern Ireland, and an NGO called the Committee for Administration of Justice. And this organization, CAJ, was working on the conditions of prisoners in Northern Ireland's prisons during the time when the IRA was quite active. And there were complaints about treatment of prisoners, prisoner abuse. And the organization had quite a lot of difficulty in getting the UK government to take these concerns at all seriously. And the main problem really was the political climate. So it was just seen as a very sensitive subject, and the government just really didn't want to touch it. But the organization had collected hard facts, it had evidence, it knew very well what was going on. It was just really struggling to get anyone to listen to them, including the media. The media also just didn't want to touch the story. So the CAJ realized that it had these blocks domestically, and it wondered, you know, how can it get past those obstacles? And it decided that the way to do that was to go to the Committee Against Torture. What it did was it submitted a shadow report, an alternative report to the Committee Against Torture, which detailed very clearly the findings that it had made. It worked on this with Amnesty International, which just gave it the Committee Against Justice a little bit of extra credibility, because it was an organization that was relatively small, so the Committee Against Torture had not really heard of them before this point. And it submitted this for the review of the United Kingdom. The committee did a number of things. The Committee for the Administration of Justice did a number of good things in making its submission. For example, it followed exactly the report that the state had produced, so it was very easy for the Committee Against Torture to see exactly where the Committee on the Administration of Justice was agreeing or disagreeing with the state report, and that's a very good general advocacy strategy. But the point was that the case received a lot of media coverage, because now the findings of the Committee on the Administration of Justice had the backing of the Committee Against Torture, so that the findings were actually included in the recommendations that the Committee Against Torture made to the UK government. And in that way, the NGO managed to sort of break that blockage. It figured out what the block was, and it managed to break it by going international. So I think that's a kind of an interesting example to see how going to the international level can actually get rid of some obstacle that's present domestically. And I think that's one way to mobilize domestic civil society, is to have them see that actually it can bring benefits. You don't have to think of it as we're going to the international system and it's going to solve everything. It's obviously going to be part of a domestic advocacy strategy, but it can actually be very effective when it's applied very strategically and thoughtfully. When it comes to the Universal Periodic Review in particular, I think it's a particularly useful mechanism for mobilizing civil society, because it is primarily a domestic tool. It's really intended to be a domestic mechanism with just a brief moment in Geneva when the review actually takes place. But for the remainder of the four and a half years between reviews, all the action is happening domestically. So it's really a good mechanism for trying to mobilize domestic civil society. And I think it has been quite successful in doing that, but obviously there are gaps and there's still room to go in mobilizing civil society domestically. So maybe I just pick up a couple of points around which civil society can be mobilized. When it comes to the UPR process, of course, you're aware that there's the preparation of the national report and there's preparation of the stakeholders report or the different NGOs reports that end up going into the stakeholders report. And they're obviously both natural points of coincidence between this international process and then the actual domestic sort of strategies of NGOs. And I think even for an NGO that's not particularly interested in following the UPR process, it's still really important and interesting to go to those consultations, to network with other NGOs, to make your advocacy points in that public forum, to meet other people who are working on those same points, and maybe form coalitions. You can get a lot of benefits just from participating in those consultations. And I would say that even if the NGO, as I say, is not planning to follow the UPR in any detail, still it's sort of a remiss in a way for it not to participate in the space that the UPR creates domestically. I think that's incredibly important. And of course, if the government holds consultations, that's a good opportunity to go to meet key government figures, to network with them and to raise your concerns. It's not always easy to meet with government figures, members of the government. So that's another opportunity that it would be quite surprising if NGOs were not taking advantage of and incorporating it into their domestic strategy. And really just making use of those spaces is really important, regardless of whether or not your recommendations end up being taken forwards and included in either the national report or the stakeholders report. And that's something very simple and easy to do without being distracted from your own domestic strategy. Indeed, I would say it should be part of your domestic strategy. Also, of course, civil society can do sort of what the Committee for the Administration of Justice did, use the UPR as a means to adding visibility to your case by creating media opportunities. So if your recommendations are being used, maybe you yourselves didn't lobby for them, but you find out that your recommendations or the sort of points that you're working on were included in the outcome report of your country, you can still use that and spin it. You can say, you know, these points were raised in the working group. These are the points we're working on. They were raised in the UPR working group in Geneva, an international mechanism. And that adds extra weight to your advocacy. So again, you don't need to sort of invest a whole lot of resources. NGOs don't need to invest all these resources in following the process extremely closely. There are ways in which they can engage and be mobilized and motivated that get them involved in the process in what is quite a useful way, which does contribute to the implementation of UPR recommendations, but which doesn't require a whole lot of investment on their part, and which in fact fits very neatly into their own domestic advocacy strategies. And there are many other ways, I'm sure, in which you'll be able to discuss and identify in which that could happen. Maybe I just make one final point, which is that I think in many cases NGOs have more to lose by not engaging than engaging, because you know, of course, that the UPR process, they can reject, states can reject and accept recommendations. And if a state rejects a recommendation, it's effectively saying that it's not going to go ahead and implement it. And when that report with that rejected recommendation in it is then adopted by the working group, it's sort of, in a way, to the government, it has the seal of approval from the working group almost. And that can undermine the work of NGOs who are actually working on advocacy in that area. So if they're really not aware of what's happened at the international level, they can just find things, you know, the government, to its own mind, has a legitimate reason to say we're not doing any work on this because we rejected that recommendation. But if the NGOs at the national level aren't aware of that, they may find themselves blocked in ways that they don't quite understand. And while the NGOs may not be able to get the government to accept the recommendation, nevertheless, if they highlight the fact that the government did reject the recommendation, that can actually be enough to mobilize opinion sort of against the government. It can actually be a way of creating indignation or getting people interested and active on your issue. So sometimes a rejected recommendation is a really good way to get people involved, because they think, you know, why is the government rejecting this? We really need to push and get them to implement that recommendation, even though it was rejected. I think maybe I'll stop here because I'd be quite interested in taking questions on that and maybe hearing people's thoughts on other ways in which domestic civil society can be mobilized. So I'll stop here and thank you very much.